What's up, y'all? Welcome back to Sources from the Sofa. We got the full lineup here today. Me, myself, Rome, we got AT and Jason. It was a hell of a football week. A full day of college football on Saturday. Lots of exciting games. The heavy hitters came and played. Some almost upsets. The NFL was a lot of fun yesterday, jam-packed in the morning. And then we were treated to like a really interesting Monday night football game with the Atlanta Falcons and the Eagles. I did not think the Falcons would actually show up like this. Kirk Cousins looked pretty decent, actually. Looked a little tight in the first half, and then kind of loosened up, scrambled a little bit, kind of got outside the pocket, had some nice throws, clutch. I don't know. I'm kind of stunned.
Yeah, Cousins looked okay, struggled in the first half, but really got things going in that two-minute drive there to lead to the Falcons on a comeback. So give him credit there. But yeah, he looked most comfortable running that two-minute offense out of the shotgun. Got some big plays in the passing game. Led the comeback for the Falcons. Big win for Atlanta. Tough loss if you're an Eagles fan.
That was a really big win for the Falcons. What did you guys think about Cousins?
I think he did enough to get by. I think what Aaron said, I mean, it struggled in the first half. Made a few plays in the second half, but it was really all on that last drive. You know, how he's able to find some open receivers. Darnell Mooney, two big catches on that last drive, hitting Drake London there in the corner. I mean, that's what they paid him all this money for. It was really that last drive right there. But, I mean, this is a case more, did the Eagles lose the game or did the Falcons actually win the game? And it's probably more the Eagles lost this game because they had it in Saquon Barkley's hand there, or Aaron's guy, Saquon Broccoli.
Yeah.
Hey, obviously the hands were still greasy from the butter on the broccoli on that play.
Yeah, me and Aaron were just briefly talking about it before you joined, Jason. I thought it was a bad call during, opting to go for a pass instead of running it. They're right there in the goal line. They did a great job last week against the Packers, you know, ramming it down. And they definitely went away from that game plan this time. And it kicked them in the ass. And they gave way too much time to the Falcons and just not enough time at the end. Dude, Jalen Hurts, turnover prone again. Like, this kind of seems like like the theme of him from like the past two seasons now.
Yeah, going back to the Eagles not running the ball. I would have ran the ball. I think it was 3rd and 3. You could have ran it, gotten 2.5 yards. I mean, they were getting big yards throughout the game running Barkley. And then obviously go to the tush push with Jalen Hurts to get the first down, and they need to ice the game. The rollout pass, Barkley in the flat, that was the right call. He was open, hit him in the hands. Yeah. He gets down, gets the first down. You take a knee, the game's over. And then Jalen Hurts, like you said, just kind of throwing it up there at the end of the game, double coverage, got a safety over the top, corner underneath, just kind of air mailed it. I would have liked to have seen him throwing it away. They had time to get a couple more plays in. All you got to do is get in field goal range, and Jake Elliott can knock down from 60 yards in the link. We've seen him do it before. So bad clock management there by Jalen Hurts. But the Eagles, yeah, this one, like Jason said, it's a tough loss given the fact that they're going into New Orleans this week to play a hot Saints team.
I just saw like this stat, I think, during the telecast that Barkley has 18 or so drops. It's like the most by running back in the past couple of years. I didn't know that, but I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. But he's been probably the biggest spark from that offense, definitely in week one, and still playing for dividends sure in week two. So it's where they're at is probably because of what Saquon's been able to do. So you want to put the ball in your playmaker's hands, just got to make plays. But when you look at Sunday night's game, you look at Monday night's game, because even early in the Monday night game, the Eagles going for it, I think it was a 4th and 4 at a certain point, didn't take the points at that time. You know, there was questionable some game management from Sirianni that I think Buck and Aitman were onto on the Monday night telecast. So there was some super questionable calls. I'm sure we'll get to it on the Sunday night telecast, where even the announcers in the moment are like, what are we doing from a game management perspective? So those are those little things where it comes down to a field goal here, 1 or 2 points there, that you take points off the board. And at the end comes to bite you when you're not managing the clock or you miss a play like that pass to Saquon.
Yeah. Besides that, though, from like week one to week two, it looks like we've had like some very back and forth performances. Out of everything you guys seen the first 2 weeks, anything that kind of sticks out? I don't know. I kind of want to go into like most impressive performances so far, especially in week two.
Week two, I mean, the most impressive team has to be the New Orleans Saints going into the Dallas Cowboys and whipping them like they did. I definitely didn't see that one coming.
No.
We talk about upsets. Saints basically came in a 7-point underdog and ran all over the Cowboys. I mean, whatever they wanted to do, they did. They ran the ball. They threw the ball deep. Their defense played good, kept the Cowboys out of the end zone. Kind of that bend but don't break, which we're kind of seeing a lot in the NFL right now early in the first 2 weeks.
Right.
So I came away with New Orleans. I mean, Derek Carr, this was a guy that the Raiders basically just shipped out of town for free. You know, pin him on an Uber, send him to New Orleans and said, get out of here.
For Garoppolo.
Of all people, Garoppolo. We might be seeing him pretty soon for the LA Rams, the way they got guys flying off the shelves on the IR. But give Derek Carr credit, man. New coordinator, OC, Kubiak coming in there, running the ball. I mean, the Saints haven't ran the ball good since Mark Ingram was there. And they controlled the line of scrimmage and beat Dallas like a drum on Sunday.
Yeah,
Kamara really came out of it. Yeah, he really came out of nowhere. I mean, not that we've all knew he's at, but from a fantasy perspective, you look, he's been off the map. This is a guy that, you know, was he hurt most of the time? Didn't even know if he was drafted. Probably took some people and some flyers at this point, but getting three touchdowns, you know, really early in this game, it was on fire. I mean, a playmaker he was in years past, but it's good to see him coming back. But yeah, Aaron mentioned with Derek Carr, there was a stat at some point throughout the game. You know, 15 consecutive drives has been a scoring drive from the Saints between the first and second game. Like,
yeah,
really, you know, unheard of offensive production here in the first two games, you know, compared to a lot of the other offenses. I did see overall from the week, you know, the Saints obviously the impressive, but first 2 weeks of the year over the past 10 years, or actually the last 5 years, the number of passing touchdowns that was going on. So 2019, 105, 22. 2020, there was 110, 2021, 110, 2022, 105, 2023 last year down to 86. Going into the Monday night game tonight, there was only 66 passing touchdowns. So like offense overall was just completely kind of a mess across the league, except the Saints, who just were scoring pretty much on every drive. And give Derek Carr's due, like Aaron was saying, he's getting them up and down the field, making plays, scoring touchdowns all over a Dallas team that you can say what you want about Dallas, but Dallas is always a September team. You know, generally they're putting up 4-4-1, 5-1 in September, putting offense up in there, you know, when it's nice and convenient in September. So a little bit of a surprising point for Dallas. This is the Dallas I expect in January, not the Dallas you see generally in September.
There's a funny meme going around. Dallas thinks it's a playoff game in September. Saints, as you mentioned, 15 drives scoring consecutively. I guess they scored 91 points. It's the fourth most in NFL history in the first 2 weeks. That's fucking crazy. Derek Carr looks phenomenal. Kubiak, I think that this might be like maybe one of the more underrated coaching hires in the offseason because they look sharp. I think we talked about initially, you know, we didn't expect the Saints to win much. We had Bucks, Falcons, and then Saints and Panthers battling out for like fourth place. But Saints have been the hottest team in the NFL. They look really good.
If you go back to what we were talking about, we said that was probably going to be one of the weakest divisions in the NFC and in the NFL overall. And the way Tampa's looked, New Orleans has looked, Atlanta getting a big win here, minus Carolina, who we thought was going to be terrible. This division is shaping up to maybe be pretty good.
Yeah, and it's going to be kind of fun.
So the Saints, like you said, I think the Kubiak guy are looking great right now. The team didn't have no vertical passing game last year. They couldn't run the ball. Right now, they're both on fire on both of those things. This is a dynamic offense. Philadelphia, like I said, comes into town this week. It'll be an interesting game because Philly's defense isn't very good. They can't stop really anybody in the passing game and in the running game. Bijan Robinson was having a nice game. Now you got Kamara and that passing attack. Saints, they might be rolling some more points up on Sunday.
Yeah, and talking about the Kubiak hire, I mean, we talked about Ben Johnson a lot in the season preview, but now Kubiak's going to be rising the ranks as like the offensive coach you're going to want. You know, as a bunch of these jobs probably come open around thing, he's probably going to have a pick of the litter. If this is going to be an offensive team, he can resurgence with David Carr. You know, what can he do with some of these other quarterbacks around the league and be the hot coaching candidate? So, yeah, I mean, very impressive from the Saints. I think just overall in the division, I don't want to get ahead of your own, but like surprising teams, I think most impressive to beyond the Saints, Aaron mentioned the Buccaneers too, 2-0 going into Detroit. I think a lot of people thought that was a, That was the Detroit gimme to go 2-0. But
that was
Baker's
next on my list.
That was next on your list. Was right there. Like, Baker's been so impressive, that a guy that basically rode off from Cleveland, and even his last season in Cleveland, I don't think was given a fair shake because he was hurt the entire year, and he was going out there playing, didn't perform. You know, they dump him. You know, Carolina didn't know what to do with him, you know, just like Carolina does, you know, does a little stint with the Rams just to help out. But, you know, signs that flyer with the Buccaneers, has a really solid season, gets himself paid, gets back into it and making plays with the weapons that they've had down in Tampa. And so the Buccaneers really impressive, because the Lions is everyone's trendy pick. And I think the Buccaneers really show that, you know, they're a team to compete as well in the NFC.
Yeah, I definitely like the Lions going to the Super Bowl, but I did pick the Bucs to win the division. Baker Mayfield, I thought he did great. When they were down, it kind of felt like the momentum was going the Lions' way, especially in the second half. I can't remember, they were probably down like 6 points or so. The Bucs got the ball back. They got pinned down to like a third and long, and then Baker kind of took off with his legs, made smart decisions. He just kind of bullied his way. He's just such a football guy. He just kind of took over the whole game and just changed from there, and didn't seem the Lions had an answer for them. Lions look kind of like shaky again on defense. It was a low scoring game. I was expecting it to be a shootout, but 2016, that was a really fun game.
Weird time. If you look at it, because you had the Lions outgain the Buccaneers by 200 yards, I think.
Yeah.
We talk about bend and don't break. Tampa did a great job once Detroit got into that red zone, just kind of shrinking the field, playing zone coverage, passing everything off, kept them out of the end zone. Put some pressure on Goff late. He made some unexpected interception throws. And Tampa's defense, I mean, we talk about Baker, and that's great, but I think the defense, with all the secondary players they had out, even some D linemen, I think a lot of people thought Detroit would go in there at home and beat them. I mean, they were a 7-point, 7.5-point favorite. Me and Rome talked about this on Thursdays, Tampa being a trendy team to get the upset, given just, you know, they lost to them twice last year, divisional round. Tampa was more hungry. The defense was a little more hungry, and they stepped up and got the job done.
Aaron says unexpected, you know, interceptions from Jared Goff, but I think those unexpected interceptions he's referring to are the expected ones you saw with the Rams and when the Lions were not as good last year. It's these untimely interceptions and turnovers from Goff that I think has separated him from whether he's truly the elite quarterback that he was supposed to be coming out of college, and kind of the above average quarterback that did get him to the Super Bowl, but wasn't the playmaker that McVay wanted in the offense, and has flashes of brilliance and a lot of weapons in Detroit. But when it goes south with them, it's usually at the hands of untimely Goff interceptions.
Another performance I really liked, I think Aaron was really up on this, was the Cardinals. We kind of talked about it, Jason, a lot last pod. I was picking the Rams to win, but that's before I knew everyone was on the IR. Everyone's injured. Everyone was in the hospital on the Rams. And Kyler Murphy, he looks great. Didn't make any mistakes.
Kyler Murray, you told us we had to correct you going forward. So just Murray.
You said Murphy, I believe.
Murray. No, he looked good. Harrison Jr., man. What, he had like over 100 yards in the first quarter. A couple touchdowns. He looked sharp. He had that nice grab at the end of the end zone. Tippy-toed. Like, that was fucking phenomenal. That was beautiful to kind of see. I didn't know that they were going to score 40 points, though. Everyone looks healthy.
Yeah, back 2 years ago before Murray and stuff got hurt, and when they started, I think, 7-1, 8-1 with Cliff Kingsbury, they got off and they were scoring 30-plus points a game. We talked about it on the show. They got a lot of weapons. Murray's looking good. He's looking strong. Second year removed from that ACL injury. And Harrison Jr., we talked about one catch for three targets for 4 yards in week one. Obviously, they came out, got him involved early, the first two drives, two TDs, 130 yards, four catches. He didn't catch the ball again. They tried to get him a couple times in the end zone. Murray missed him on a couple fade routes to the corner. They run the ball good. But yeah, the Rams, with all the injuries they got, I mean, they're basically blowing up my phone team. I want to come out of retirement and play with them right now.
Yeah, the injuries, without Aaron Donald this year, I think was always going to be a question of like...
The Rams.
Yeah, you have... the best defensive player probably of the last decade, at least making the most impact up the middle, that, you know, demands that extra attention in the interior defensive line, that the offense needs almost double team, that allows those pass rushers off the edge, that was really getting a lot of guys paid off the edge for the Rams. because so much pressure was applied by Donald and attention needed to be played from onside linebacking, which just made the whole defense behind him better. So there was going to be a natural potential step back, and now you got all these injuries piling up. Going to be very tough for the Rams with, you know, a lot of firepower in that division. Although, at the same time, the 49ers haven't been able to stay healthy either. So there could be an opening here for the Cardinals or the Seahawks, while both of these teams that are usually the perennial 1-2 in the division, you know, have all these injuries to start the season. And a lot of times in the NFL, it's really about health. Who's going to play the majority of games from your star players and who's not? And that could be the difference of one or two games that you're in a bye or, you know, potentially out of the playoffs sometimes.
Yeah, well, the Niners were so healthy last year. I expected some regression this year, and you're starting to see that war of attrition, right? CMC is going to be out. Debo is going to be out now for a few games. So we'll see how Purdy can, like, weather the storm. Besides Cardinals, Saints, Bucks, I thought the Bills also had a really impressive performance. I think, like, those were, like, the four best games this week. Out of all those four, who do you guys think are going to be able to sustain this throughout the season?
I mean, it's early, 2 weeks in, so it's kind of hard to say who's going to be able to sustain it going forward. I'm curious to see the Saints. They've got the Eagles this weekend. I think they get the job done and get the 3-0. Bills are looking strong. They're part of a doubleheader next Monday with Jacksonville. Talking about teams that have been disappointing, Jacksonville at 0-2. But, yeah, Saints looking really strong. And Tampa Bay, I think with that defense and Baker, they got to get the running game going. That's always been a problem with Tampa Bay. Can they get the running game going, sustain that? And their offensive line, they had one of their tackles out. I think Aiden Hutchinson had, what, 4.5 sacks just in that game alone.
He killed it.
I mean, given the fact that Detroit outgained them 200 yards and all the sacks and pressures they put on Baker, it's quite remarkable that Tampa did come out with that win.
Yeah, going back to that Thursday night game, Roman, I think for me it was the Bills. We talked about in the season preview, you know, losing the weapons they did on the outside, kind of rebuilding around Josh Allen. He's kind of going to do it by himself. James Cook, I said, was going to be kind of the key, you know, going forward. Can you get him involved with the run game? He had a phenomenal, he had a phenomenal game. And I really, that's really the difference. I think them long term, you know, does James Cook get the ball, make a difference? They establish the running game, take that pressure off of Josh Allen. He's able to get the ball around to some of the wide receivers, and as they grow throughout the year, with the Dolphins lacking, you know, some offense and defense right now. This offense in Miami is not as impressive as it was 12 months ago when they were coming out of the gates, throwing the ball all over the place to Waddle and Tyreek. Tua is going to be out. Who knows how long that's going to be? And the Jets, you know, good comeback this week, but, you know, didn't look great the first week. But the Bills, you know, Aaron and I think beginning of the year, both said they're going to be outside looking in. But right now, they're still kind of that class of the AFC East right now, just reforming the identity that, you know, they had without Stephon Diggs.
Yeah, real quick, Dolphins, because me and Aaron were able to talk a little bit about it. We didn't really touch on Tua too much on the last pod, but kind of curious now we got more updates. What do you think, Jason? What do you think, Aaron? First of all, the very controversial thing, should he retire? And then second, yeah, should he retire?
Not a doctor, so I don't have all the medical history and all that knowledge that goes on. Do I think he's going to retire? No. I think he's going to take a few weeks off, come back, give it a try again. And then if something happens, another head injury this year or something severe in the next year or two, I think you'll probably look at him to start hanging it up.
Go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, I agree with Aaron. I'm not going to tell anyone to retire. It's going to be based on him and his doctor and how it goes. I agree with Aaron that I don't think he will retire. If it's going to be, I guess, what's going to happen. Last year, through the year, entirely healthy. You know, so that, I think that was a lot of the conversation going into last year was, oh, is he going to stay healthy? And he did the entire year. So early in the season, already at this point, got signed to the big contract. He's going to play. But, you know, it's something interesting to look at because that's going to be the round him every time this guy takes a big hit. Is he okay every time? Which is, it's a scary thing to watch on the field.
It wasn't even a big hit.
It wasn't. You never know. We say that sitting on our couch, you know, from all the sources Aaron does having on the sofa at this point, if we're going to tie in the name of the show in here, but you don't know what hit's going to be, at which side it's going to be. It doesn't have to be the loudest one, but any of those hits can be the one at this point. But you know, how does he take care of himself within the pocket? Be smart. He's a football player. He wants to play. This is what these guys get to that level for. But is he going to have, you know, it's probably too early to talk about. Is he going to have the longest career? Maybe not. You know, you think about Troy Aikman's career in our childhood, it feels like his career was forever, but it basically was just kind of the 90s. And, you know, that was kind of it, because he had the same thing. We just never saw it on the field. It wasn't talked about. Now, I think there's just a sense of awareness, knowing the long-term effects from all his concussions. Now, you know, as an audience, we want to see this guy live a long and productive, happy life and not have to worry about long-term effects of brain damage.
Here's two things. It's like, if you have like narcolepsy, right, you can't be a race car driver. It's going to be fucking bad for everybody. He's just not big enough. Sometimes people are just not meant to take a hit. And the way he got hit kind of looks like when I'm drunk falling on top of my pillow. But instead, he was falling over on Hamlish. It didn't look crazy at all. I think he might miss one or two games, come back. But if he gets one more concussion like that, I know he's not guaranteed the full salary if he retires on his own terms. He only gets what was initially guaranteed from the beginning of the contract. But if he's medically deemed unable to play, then he collects the full guaranteed contract. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the hit, like Jason said and you guys said, didn't look very severe, but it was still a head and neck shot. And he did play every game last year, and he bulked up like 10, 15 pounds. He actually lost, I think, 14 pounds, they mentioned, this offseason to kind of get a little quicker on his feet. And he was practicing jiu-jitsu and ways to go down and not take such severe hits.
Well, he wasn't diving head first last year either.
Exactly. And he didn't need to do that there. He already had the first down. Just slide, get down, avoid the contact. I mean, I get it. You're trying to lead your team back and get the win. And, you know, you're not really quite sure where that yard marker is. You got an idea. So, you know, you lunge, you take that hit, get that extra yard, yard and a half, get the first down. So we'll see. We'll see what the medicals are coming up for him. I think he will be back. But, you know, it's a fragile state of mind. Concussions, like Jason said, are being looked at a lot more severe now. So we don't want any, you know, long-term effects going forward. I think he'll come back, give it a try. And if all goes well, hopefully it does for him. He doesn't have another concussion, but it's definitely something that's going to be brought up for his future going forward.
Coolest transition. I do want to talk about one more performance I really dug this week. That's Aaron's Packers. Willis, what a game plan they had set up for him. He didn't throw a lot. I can't remember how much he threw. It was like less than, what, 18 passes or so?
12 or 14, I believe he was, for 122 yards.
One touchdown. Jacobs ran the ball really well. He had 150 yards, I think. Aaron, since you're the Pack guy, break it down for us.
I told you Thursday, Green Bay would keep it simple. You got a great offensive coach in Matt LaFleur. Give him the ball, easy throws. Get him out rolling the pocket, just simple out routes, quick passes, make the game simple, run the ball, don't turn it over. That's the recipe for success for Green Bay. Should have won that game a lot more than they did. Obviously, Josh Jacobs fumbling right there on the goal line. I think they would have went up 17-0 at that time. And play good defense. We talked about the Packers.
Is that in the first half?
That was in the first half. The Packers defensively, we said they got to play better. They played well, confused a young quarterback who's not accurate. Forced him into bad decision making. So the Packers did what they had to do.
What games you guys want to talk about? Like anything that kind of stuck in your mind? You wanted to go Browns, Deshaun Watson kind of looking somewhat decent, beating up on the Jags. Trevor Lawrence, he doesn't look the same. He's lost, what, 7 or 9 games in a row now?
I don't know if Trevor Lawrence, or you say, ever looks the same. As a Justin Fields apologist for several years in Chicago, like there'd always be things popping up on my timeline that compares Trevor Lawrence to Justin Fields passing stats that were very eerily similar, that the hype around, you know, Trevor Lawrence wasn't matching the results and what he was putting up. And he has not lived up to that billing thus far. And their collapse at the end of last year, I think, was very telling of that team overall. Now, he did have train wrecks at head coach early on, so I think that's some of maybe the past that he gets in these early performances, but there needs to be moments right now where he's, you know, taking charge of that team. he has had consistently pretty solid weapons around him. They've drafted him another pretty good weapon in Thomas, who had, you know, a big catch this week. I think two catches for like 94 yards. So some playmakers to boot. ETN has been a solid running back so far this past couple of years to be able to rely on. So there's things around them that are nice, but Lawrence being able to take that next step, the biggest question mark for him going forward, because he really needs to lead this team in a division that, you know, will compete with the Texans, you know, to win. But you got the Titans, who have looked pretty bad so far, and the Colts, who have not looked great either. So there's an opportunity for Jacksonville to make the playoffs. They should be a playoff team with some very winnable games and a pretty good schedule down the road, but has not looked great thus far. And Trevor Lawrence taking that next step really is going to be the key for them to be a playoff team and have future success.
You mentioned the Titans. They're 0-2. They're one of the handful of teams that are 0-2 right now. Levis looks like crap. I don't know if you heard about his head coach talking shit on him in the middle of the game, and then afterwards in the press conference, it wasn't a good look. But I was kind of surprised how close that Titans-Jets game was. It made me uncomfortable.
Levis is going to give us a great play for a highlight every week. It's going to be a terrible play, but there's going to be something noteworthy from a Levis interception every week. So I need him to stay in just for that, you know, just for that highlight fodder. First, you know, the praying to his knees to really giving the Bears the win in week one, obviously, I love. But even this week, there was some just insane stuff he's going through. He does not want to go down. And sometimes everyone will tell you from a quarterback expert, it's just good to just throw it away and punt the ball and not try to do something that's going to just be an insanely bad interception or turnover.
Yeah, I was watching the game when he did that shovel pass.
Yeah, I mean, I love Will Levis. I mean, I had the Bears week one in the Survivor Pool circa, and that saved me. I sent him a jar of mayo. I hope he got it. But yeah, like Jason said, Will Levis, just sometimes you just don't know when to give up on plays, eat sacks, throw the ball away. He's a highlight reel in the wrong way. He's a fantasy defense's dream come true. If you're playing against him, he's going to give you a few turnovers, maybe a few scores the other way. So for Tennessee, I mean, everybody in that division right now is 0-2 behind the Texans. Going back to Jacksonville, Trevor Lawrence, they just can't finish drives inside the red zone. You know, four drives in the red zone, one touchdown, two field goals. They make too many mistakes in the red zone, turning the ball over, and they don't convert and get touchdowns. Those are both recipes for not success on Sundays in the National Football League.
Yeah, you mentioned everyone's 0-2. I think Colts could have won easily, you know, those two games. Titans could have easily won these games. Texans. Well, first, before we go to the Texans, do you guys feel better about A-Rod with the Jets? Not a lot of passing yards. I think he hasn't thrown for 300 yards now since, what, 2020? 2022?
I mean, I'm not so concerned about the passing game. I mean, for me, it's mobility. Obviously, he's 40-year-old cornerback coming off the Achilles tear. So his ability to get out of the pocket and make plays and keep plays alive aren't just there anymore. So unless he's got a great pocket, they're going to struggle in the passing game. They've got good running backs. They, you know, showcased another one on Sunday. Their screen game is really looking good. Their run game is good. For the Jets, it's simple. Play great defense, hold teams to field goals, and have Aaron Rodgers have a chance to win in the fourth quarter. And he came through and finished the Titans off when they had the chance.
Yeah, Aaron talked about the running game. Rodgers doesn't need to do what he was doing in Green Bay. There is legit running backs with Breece Hall and I think it's Braylon Allen or something. That was the guy making big plays this weekend too. So there is a lot there on the running game to be able to him hand the ball off and then make plays in the passing game when it matters. And as he comes back, you know, he's going to get better from a health perspective, I think, as things going through, and they'll be able to, you know, air it out when deemed. But I don't think he needs to be running around doing what he was doing in his prime. He came here because the Jets have a really good defense that was seen as, hey, this whole team's a quarterback away. That's what we were hearing during the Zach Wilson era. It's everything but the quarterback. So a lot of times you need the quarterback really just to make the right plays at the right time and not have to be the savior and carry everything on their back. And they have the weapons around Rodgers to do that. So was a tough opening look for week one versus the Niners, but they needed to bounce back in this way. And definitely an opportunity for them to continue to grow within that division with the Dolphins not looking as good. And then the Patriots they've been surprising the Patriots, but I still think
Let's talk about them.
Okay. All right.
I like them. I think they're playing competitive. They look pretty good to me. The defense is pretty solid. They go after the ball. They're playing for Mayo. They almost won again. You know, Seahawks came from behind, which is a good win for them. They don't look like a 4-win team. They look better than that.
They're playing competitive right now. I mean, will they get more than 4 wins? We'll see. They play the Jets on Thursday night, likely a loss. I mean, for them, it's been defense, defense, defense. Gerard Mayo's been there forever. He's part of the defensive culture of Bill Belichick, so he knows that group, part of the draft process, part of bringing these players in. So they're running basically kind of the same scheme, same unit. On offense, Jacoby Brissett, you know, they have no wide receivers. So three pass completions to the wide receivers on Sunday. They went all tight end, run game. Long-term in the NFL, you're not going to win that way. They just don't have enough offense. They don't have any weapons on the outside. That's kind of why they got Brissett in there versus Drake May.
Right.
Brissett can manage the game. No turnovers. Let's run it. Ball control, time of possession. Have our defense go out there, make you make mistakes. Give Seattle a ton of credit. They were down in that game, rallied back to tie it, and then went in overtime. Seattle, we talked about, could be a surprise team in the NFC, given the injuries to the Rams and 49ers. And those teams got some matchups coming up here. We talked about Roman looking ahead to week 6. These two teams, Niners, play at Seattle. This could be for an early division lead.
Yeah, I know me and you had Seattle maybe second in the division and getting a playoff spot. So with everything happening, it might unfold like that.
And going back to the Patriots, I think they're part of the theme when you look at the teams that are really utilizing the running game, taking pressure off the quarterback. I mentioned earlier just the amount of passing touchdowns, a pretty steep decline this year in 2 weeks versus previous years. But it goes into running games and these teams understanding what are they going to do to win the game. Aaron mentioned relying on the defense, controlling the ball. You know, the Patriots putting the ball in Ramondre Stevenson's hands, let him run. He's had over 200 yards in 2 games so far. And then utilizing tight ends like Hunter Henry. You know, I think this is what we expected Hunter Henry to do when Belichick was there, to be more of like that passing guy and be a difference maker in some of the Patriots offenses of old. So they're going to play close to the vest. I think more than a 4-win team, but probably scraping around in that seven area still.
They look like a fun team to watch so far. I don't know where to go from here, guys. I kind of want to talk about
Aaron was already taking shots to me about the Sunday night performance. So I don't know if you're saving that for the end for me to defend the Bears.
I mean,
let's go into it. Yeah.
I was taking shots at the whoever the Bears got up in that booth telling the coach to challenge replays. We talked about it briefly. I mean, these were as clear as day. I don't know. You know, that guy should be fired right away. I mean, those two timeouts really hurt the Bears, especially in the second half.
You're assuming there was actually a person that had that job because the second challenge, Eberflus was right in front of it when he did it. Like, the guy was right there and challenged it. So, I mean, it was some very questionable stuff from Eberflus. So, you're assuming a person has that job.
So, what you're telling me is the Bears are the only team in the National Football League that does not have a guy up in the booth telling the coach to challenge.
They wouldn't be the first team in Chicago that's been skimpy on the budget that has roles that doesn't have roles they should do.
Well,
it might track.
Now you see why they're losing games that, you know, they would have shots at winning.
So that game was kind of close too.
Jason should volunteer for that gig. I heard he comes pretty cheap on the per challenge cost.
Yeah, definitely would come cheap on that. If that person does exist up there, where they even listen to is the other person too, because, you know, the interception challenge was pretty much, you know, player on the field convincing coach, I caught it, when the broadcast showed you it probably hit the ground twice.
How many times have we seen players say they caught it and it's just sitting there trapped against their chest? I mean, I've never heard a player really come up and say I didn't catch it. It's very rare that they ever do. I mean, you're
schoolyard
excited.
Catch, you think, playground catch.
You think you got the catch. It was close. I mean, he tried, but it was incomplete twice. And then the pass to Stephon Diggs on the sidelines. I mean, he got basically 3 feet in with 5 yards to spare, palming it with one hand, showing you caught the ball.
So, like, what I
don't know.
Caught
from, I mean, the Bears need to get a guy up there for sure.
Besides that, what I caught from the Bears and Texans game, I'm kind of worried for Caleb Williams. Like, doesn't it look like he has a lot of protection?
No, does definitely not have enough
I'm scared for
protection.
his life. There's a
Yeah,
funny a meme thing, on Twitter or something like that, where it shows Justin Fields just beat the hell up, just exhausted on the bench, and now they have Caleb Williams doing the same face, the same look, just playing, just being quarterback for the Bears.
it's what it'll do to you. I mean, it's what it'll do. They're both wearing the orange jersey, which is what the meme you're
Yeah.
referring to was
Oh, you
even better
saw
because it. Oh, I saw it. My entire
it?
timeline. If there is a Bears game and they are losing, I it's on my timeline, and everyone will definitely send me a text.
I'm
But if you
sorry,
look at,
Jason.
it's fine. It's fine. If you look at any Bears fan in media and they will talk through the same story. The Bears fan inside will be scared to play a primetime game because when the Bears play in primetime, this is the exact offensive performance that you always see. The questions from the Bears will always be the same. The offensive coordinator, what is his strategy? What is the scheme? We can't get a play into the huddle. We can't get the right play that Caleb's go taking everything down to 1 second on the play clock to make adjustments. The false starts and the penalties because people are confused. Wide receivers don't know what to do in motion. So there was a lot going on there, and this is, year one of Shane Waldron as the offensive coordinator coming from the McVay tree, had some success in Seattle getting Geno there. So he's got some success, but there's something about Chicago that will make a good offensive mind go bad. There is something about Chicago that will make all Pro Bowl wide receivers turn into, pedestrian wide receivers that are getting one catch and look as frustrated as DJ Moore did, at certain parts of the game. But the protection aspect, which you talked about, is the biggest takeaway. And in Caleb's defense, that's, problem number one. At next gen stats, I saw it was like 23 of 48 drop packs were a pressure, and they had 36 total individuals of those 48 rushes that he had pressure on there. There was clear, plays where Caleb's dropping back and the offensive lineman does not block anyone right in front of him. The center's going off. They have no idea how to protect stunts. Anytime they brought the blitz or they were doing stunts up line, people were lost. Plenty of viral videos of Nate Davis or Tevin Jenkins or any of
Right.
these guys just running past defenders when they're going to the second level as people are coming in, just burying, Swift as he gets the ball handled. So the offensive line, as it should, be the most criticized unit. Caleb did miss some passes too, as well. So there was definitely opportunity. That's going to happen. In his defense, though, there was sh sh moments, which will be the defense in the first quarter. Steps up into the pocket, delivers kind of like a really tight throw, through some traffic in the pocket, hits the receiver, and those are the special plays that I think he can do. But right now, he's got basically 2.2 seconds back there when I think so far this year he has the fastest release time of any quarterback in the NFL, and he's still not getting the time. So there is plenty of to do for this offense this week to clean this stuff up because, yeah, the offensive line is not doing any favors to help this team.
So one thing I
But
want to do, Nathan, on a weekly, I just want to do like a panic meter. We're going to post it on the socials. This is the Bears panic meter, Jason's panic meter. We're going to get your face blown up like one of those Eli Manning casts. Put your face in there. Beginning of the season, I would say like a panic meter for you is like a 1 out of 10, right?
yes.
What is it now? Week two. After week two, how are you feeling?
He's not panicked.
I'm not panicked at all. I'm
Yeah.
not panicked at all. What you look at what Caleb can do, and if you compare him to Justin Fields and Mitch Trubisky, which no one's gonna want to listen to me talking about those two, but the release point in the pocket and how long they hold on to the ball was always what held them back from being successful when the offensive line wasn't as good. So, there are some things to clean up, but if you give Caleb a little more time, there is some opportunities for him to make plays here. Where I question some of the stuff with Shane Waldron and the scheming, like we know maybe the offensive line isn't good or some of the schemes aren't as good, so everything was a side screen to Swift, in the flat. It was a bubble screen to Swift or DJ Moore that was going nowhere that the Texans like saw right away. So, and then when they were trying to stretch the field, we were just slinging the ball downfield and not really have any rhyme or reason to it. So there's things to clean up there, but if you're gonna put the panic meter, I'm the same as I was in week one right now. There's still a lot to be going forward. And if you looked at any prediction, there was no one, when I say no one, but very few people thought the Bears were beating the Texans in week two. The Bears were going to be 1-1 through 2 weeks. And anyone doing predictions, that's exactly where the Bears are right now. Now, we didn't beat the Titans like they should have in week one, and the offense hasn't shown much. But if you're telling me they're 1-1, this is what everyone would have predicted the Bears to be after 2 weeks. So the panic meter is not panicked.
It's not there.
Yeah. Bears 1-1. To elaborate on what Jason and you guys said, I mean, the offensive line definitely has their woes and their problems, but they don't have a running game going right now. They can't run the ball. And they just got to get, they tried to keep running the ball outside tackle, outside the ends of the tight ends. Everything was outside. They're just trying to outspeed the Texans, which was a bad move. And the Texans changed up their game plan. DeMarco Ryan, those guys, I think they blitzed like 50, 60% of the time. That's something they never do. They're towards the bottom in blitzing. They played a lot of man-to-man, which typically they played zone. They played a lot of zone in the first half, and Caleb lit them up, I think, 10 for 12. And then the passing game, he missed some throws. He had DJ Moore a couple times, one-on-one on the outside, probably just feeling the pressure, the rush, getting hit, not setting his feet, missing guys. He had a wide-open throw on the sidelines, missed, can't think of the speedster guy, for he 5 yards out in front of him, had him for a good corner route for completion. But Caleb showed improvement. But going forward, I think if you're a Bears fan, you saw that, you know, they didn't have Keenan Allen. We didn't not mention that. He's great against man-to-man and getting open on those quick 5-6 yard routes. They really missed that on Sunday against the Texans. They got to get a run game going with Swift. And then, you know, DJ Moore is going to be DJ Moore. But for the Bears, their defense is really, really good to hold the Texans down. We're not talking about they held the Texans to 19 points and had the ball with a chance to win the game. So give the Bears a ton of credit with all the woes they had and all the hits Caleb took. And he took a beating. He's sore. He's probably on ice right now as we speak. The panic meter for the Bears, I think, is low. And they got the Colts coming up on the road. They're the worst run defense right now, the Colts.
The worst.
So that's, yeah, they're giving up. I think they gave up 261 total yards rushing against Green Bay. And Green Bay didn't even have a quarterback, like we said, in Malik Willis. You knew Green Bay was throwing the ball short. So for the Bears, can they get the running game going? Can the Colts stop that running game on Sunday? And then can they get some one-on-one pass plays and connect on them?
Yeah, Aaron brought up the running outside piece. If you looked at on, I know you're not on Bears Twitter like I am, but former Bears offensive lineman Olin Krutz, you know, great center back in the day for the prime Bears team, and Kyle Long, they were going back and forth a little bit on Twitter, but you know, they were even saying, why are you running outside? You know, get the ball inside. You have, you know, top tier defensive ends that are able to their speed on the outside that you're not going to get through. Run the ball inside. So there's definitely the opportunity for how they can establish that run from a scheme perspective, from what they need to do from an offensive line. The lessons learned they need to take going forward is there. I'm not panic Rome, I want to go back to, but I will take us back to preseason to Eberflus. I don't think he should be panicked just yet, but if he doesn't get the offensive turned around in some sort of direction where this team has a winning record, like, that's the person I think out of anyone that should be panicked, because I've seen it in Bears coaches of the past who cannot get this offense into a place. Like, this is a cycle of Bears football, and this is supposed to be the cycle that breaks offensively, but the Bears historically always have a great defense. So a defense in 2 weeks has only given up 3 points in the second half between the two games. So Eberflus can build the defense, can call a good defense because he's calling the defense, but game managing is calling into question. Aaron mentioned the challenges. So as the head coach, you got to be on top of the game management. And then how are you having your offensive team, you know, develop? So what is Shane Waldron going to do to get the run game going and fix up the things on the offensive line for Kayla to set up? So Matt Eberflus, I think, has the eye on him because he needs to take the step. You know, they went from, you know, 3 wins to 7 wins last year. They got to be at 9 or 10 wins this year and continue to take the step because of what they've added. So that is the expectation coming out of Hallis Hall, because they're not going to take 7 wins or less this year from a team that they've invested so much into.
Yeah, I think only Bears fans expect 10 or plus wins. I don't know anyone else outside of that who expects that much winning out of Chicago, but I do think they're going to be competitive. Let's talk about, though, like the surprise ace in that division, Vikings. Darnold looking nice. Speaking of which, the two quarterbacks that were with the Carolina Panthers, Darnold and Baker are flourishing right now. Isn't that kind of weird?
Well, you got them in better systems with good offensive coaches. You know, Dave Canales got Baker turned around. You had Shanahan with Sam Darnold. So we've seen coaches, especially great offensive minds in this league, they can take a quarterback, kind of rebuild them, remodel them up, get them back going in the right direction. And now you got Kevin O'Connell with the Vikings. He's a really good coach, comes from the McVay tree.
He's good, yeah.
So he called a really good game. Vikings have weapons. You know, we talked about they got weapons. They got a good defense with Flores' second year there. They're aggressive. They're really, really aggressive on defense. Took it to the Niners. That was the key. They took it to the Niners, stopped them on multiple fourth downs, stopped them in the red zone, forced turnovers. I mean, Purdy, if you look at his numbers, still passed for 300 yards, but I think he had a turnover, pick, a fumble, stopped them on fourth down twice in that game.
Yeah.
We're going to find out how good Minnesota is this weekend with the Texans coming in. I think we're going to get a good barometer on where they're at, because this is, you know, the first team. I mean, the Giants, I don't really take much from that. We can probably talk about the Giants later. They looked a bit better, but
it's up to you guys. We don't have to. But yeah, Darnold had like that big dart.
97 yarder to Jefferson. That was nice.
Right. I'm like, oh my God, he looks so confident, poised, making the right reads, the right decisions, and the right system. I'm really happy for him, actually. I'm really happy.
There's something to be said as these quarterbacks that are starting in year one with so much hype, don't get the shot,
right?
Not in the right system from the beginning. You know, you mentioned the Carolina Panthers. This would also be two quarterbacks for the Jets that they've kind of messed up. But Geno has found late career success after a botched run with the Jets. And now Sam Darnold initially with the Jets, they didn't have success and get him the shot. So system, I think, has a lot to do with it, and making sure you're giving these quarterbacks things that are going to be play to their strengths. And weapons obviously matter, and where things are at and how you call the game. But, you know, as guys mature in this league and see different things, you know, this is what, you know, sometimes you're going to expect at the level that they were supposed to be at when they were highly touted prospects. Because, you know, coming out of top tier college programs, you know, these guys have the talent. It's just about sometimes getting reps and being on the right team and the right system to do that. So Aaron and I, pretty sure we buried the Vikings because of my love for the Bears, Aaron's love for the Packers, and then knowing where the Lions are at. But we said this is going to be the best division in football. It may not shake out the way we thought, but I think you have a division right now with 2-2-0 teams and 3-1-1 teams. So I think it's going to be competitive all year, but the Vikings are, you know, they're going to keep it close and not be not take the step off without Kirk Cousins like we potentially
had. Yeah, they're not going to be the punching bag, which I think that's like the big wake up call. Out of all the 2-0 teams, are they like the biggest surprise 2-0 team?
It's tough.
Want me to list them all?
I'm looking at the teams right now.
Bills, Chargers, Chiefs, my beloved Steelers winning another ugly game. We got Texans, then Seahawks, Vikings, Saints, and Bucks. I did write down the Eagles because I was putting this list together while I was in the fourth quarter of the Monday night game, and then I just had to cross it off. I even had the 0-2 Falcons crossed off my 0-2 list. So thanks, Falcons.
Yeah, man, I think that's tough because the Vikings probably could be, because I think if you're looking week two versus the Niners, everyone was saying that's probably a loss without, you know, an effective quarterback.
But you know, the Niners haven't won in Minnesota in almost a decade.
I would go with the Buccaneers being the surprise 2-0 team.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, they went into Detroit as a road team and won. Not so. Tonight. Yeah, I mean, the Vikings, they had the Giants week one. We're not surprised they won that game. Week two, 49ers, a short week, long travel. We know West Coast teams don't do good traveling, and they played on Monday night, late game, McCaffrey out. And like you said, Rome, they do not play well in Minnesota. So that, I would say Minnesota and Tampa Bay are probably the surprise 2-0 teams.
How about the Saints?
You could add them too.
Yeah, just all three.
That division for the most part, yeah.
Well, the trend of this was pretty much what Aaron and I said early for some of these teams that potentially would be division dwellers are 2-0 right now. The Saints, the Buccaneers, the Vikings.
I mean, I like the Buccaneers, but the Saints, no.
Yeah,
I didn't see the Saints coming.
Even the Bills. Even the Bills 2-0. I think we're not sure about that.
Yeah, I mean, I had the Bills. I said Arizona possibly would beat them week one, and I thought Miami would beat them here in week two, since Miami had been talking about, you know, they'd lost, what, 11 out of 13 or 11 out of 12 to Buffalo. They've been talking to get a home game short week, and they laid an egg.
Yeah, you guys talked to me about the Bills being in the playoffs. I bought into it, saw that rough beginning of the schedule.
It still is rough.
Yeah, it's still rough, but yeah, Josh Allen looks good. Let's briefly talk about a quick upset, I think, with the Las Vegas Raiders. I did not see that one coming. It was an ugly game. It felt like it lasted forever. I don't even know what the hell happened at the end of that game. It was so confusing, so frustrating. You guys have a take on it?
Well, surprising 0-2 teams. We've gone this far and not talking about the Baltimore Ravens. That's a very surprising 0-2 team for me that should be in the AFC Championship game competing for the Super Bowl. I think they're still there because they're going to play some good games down the stretch, but not a game that they should be losing. Lamar is doing a lot right now, but there's been some very, you know, questionable things. Maybe I'm more personally affected because they've turned Mark Andrews into a left tackle instead of getting him in there in the passing game. Finally, some stuff down the stretch when they were behind to get stuff to him, to get him involved in the passing game. Casey
hasn't been happy.
No, and maybe that's the bias I'm bringing into this conversation. But yeah, that's not a game that Baltimore should lose. I think they're definitely there. One of the bigger things I think out of there was Justin Tucker missing a field goal, or a couple field goals, actually. Did he miss two?
I thought he missed two, but I looked at it, but it was just the one.
Oh, just the one? Okay.
Yeah.
But
a lot more misses recently. I don't know. Is he like on the downside of his career? There's been like a lot of talk on that.
Well, I think he's 1-for-7 over his last 7 kicks from 50 plus yards. So yeah, he's not Mr. Automatic from that range anymore.
No.
Which is something, because if you looked at that, you know, I don't want to bring the Bears back up, but if you look at the Bears game last night, you know, Fairbairn was in field goal range as soon as they crossed the 50. So, I mean, he was going to put that in from 68 or something last night for where he was at. So that's a,
I think he has 6 field goals over 50 plus already for the first 2 weeks of the year.
Yeah, I mean,
missed that.
Jaime Fairbairn, the kicker for the Texans. So
Mr. UCLA, I mean, Bruin himself.
Yeah, so when you don't have that, where Justin Tucker was so automatic, you know, everywhere, and plus 50 plus, and he's not, you know, that's a little bit, you know, of a game changer. I know people won't talk about, but, you know, the most accurate kicker in NFL history isn't hitting some of these ones that's 50 plus. Could be, you know, a deciding factor down the stretch that, you know, is plus or minus 1 or 2 games that decides, you know, whether you're going to win the division or, you know, get the much-needed first-round bye. But very, very confusing game. But these are the type of Minshew games that come out of nowhere where he's not going to consistently give it to you. But man, there's gonna be a game where all of a sudden he's just slinging the ball every which way. It all falls the right direction, and they pick up the win. Maybe this is
like
the one that we do.
Like, he just has like that dog at him, you know. He's like a little chihuahua. Just has like that bite. You know, he's good for a couple rounds, and it looks like he did that yesterday. One thing about the Ravens, go ahead.
Yeah, well, Minshew stunk the first 6 quarters of the year. He stunk against the Chargers week one. He stunk the first half against the Ravens. So, I mean, but in the fourth quarter, I think he threw for like almost 150 yards. TD to Davante Adams.
Davante was even happy?
I mean, they got the win, and he got the ball. So, yeah, Baltimore's kind of like one of these weird teams. Even last year, we seen it like, I think they lost 3 games last year when they had 10-point leads in the fourth quarter.
What's the thing? And it's not just... It's been like the Harbaugh era.
It's been a
era.
Trend. It's been a trend for them.
They have leads going in the fourth quarter, or like they do questionable calls. They might go for 2 when they shouldn't, or they go for like a 4th-and-1 when maybe they shouldn't. They kind of gamble a lot. And to me, like, it just looks like weird game management from Harbaugh. Like, it's always confusing. It's almost as frustrating as watching some Steelers games. And I just couldn't, it wasn't mathing for me last night. And
yeah, I mean, you know, Jason talked about a lot of these coaches are going towards analytics and kind of what, you know, the numbers say versus I kind of like to go how the team's going, how the field's going.
feel, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just like, you know, going back to the game tonight, the Eagles, fourth and four, first drive, you take the 3 points, you go up 3-0, you're feeling good about yourself. You don't get any points there. Falcons go down, they score, they take the first lead. So you sometimes you just got to take points when they're there, especially early in games. Just get the momentum on your side, let your defense go out there and play. Minshew, you know, they got to give the Raiders a ton of credit defensively. They got a couple turnovers, forced three and outs, did not let the Ravens score their final three drives in the fourth quarter. That was really the deep difference. Baltimore's defense got tired being on the field. And when you get tired, you don't have a pass rush, and you get one-on-one with Devontae Adams. They hit him. Brock Bowers, we haven't mentioned him yet. Nine catches, I think, for 98 yards. Stud guy, maybe, you know, early possible, you know, offensive rookie of the year. So the Raiders, they've been better than we thought. We didn't give them a lot of credit for week one because, you know, Antonio Pierce, even he made a bad decision in the fourth quarter in that game. It was a
Yeah.
fourth and three chance to get it down, be down seven instead of 10. They go for it and get stopped. A lot of coaches across the league, both collegiately and in the NFL, a lot of bad the clock management, just, you know, analytical decisions, not taking points when they're there.
Why do you think that's happening?
I don't know. I think, you know, I don't know. You know, Jason said the Bears don't have a guy up there doing replays. Every team now has analytical nerd guys up there that say, hey, the numbers show, go for it. Hey, the probability 65% we're going to get it. You know, even ESPN, if you watch games, would be like, oh, fourth and three. The analytics say, kick it. You know, the analytics say there's a 67% probability you're going to get it. I think NBC stats have that. You know, when the Texans or Bears, you know, for a fourth and two, oh yeah, let's go for it. And I think, you know, that was one of the plays where Caleb was supposed to throw a quick screen pass and the whole line didn't block anybody. He ate a sack right at midfield. So I think the guys
Nope.
look at the numbers and go, well, you know, 70% chance, let's go for it, instead of, hey, let's pin them inside the 10. Our defense is kicking ass. Let's get another three and out and a new set of downs right at where we're at right now.
Old football coach told me, take the points, coach. And a lot of times when they're in a certain area where, hey, we're going for fourth down because we're trying to get seven, and they could just take the three and where it's at and part of the field, or hey, at this point, let's punt the ball, pin them deep. Play defense, you know, whether the stats say it or not. I think, and a lot of times when you look at these stats, when you mentioned NBC putting this stuff, okay, it's a 65% versus 35, or it's 55 versus 45. Yeah, it's a percentage swing either way. One thing that always bothers me personally, I'll tell you, and like, not that I know the inner workings of every organization, and I probably will be proven wrong because some successful coaches do it, but the head coach position that's also the play caller always somewhat bothers me for how they are managing the game and able to be doing the play calling. And I think Andy Reid will probably say, hey, it works because he does it. But, you know, I look at Eberflus calling the defense and then making two questionable flags there. And then other coaches around the league that need to do the play calling on their side of the ball where they're hired. Does that take away from them actually managing the overall game and some of these decisions in a timely manner? I always have questions about that. There's a lot going on in those, you know, precious 25 to 30 seconds between plays. And if you are focused on the play call versus the overall game management, like who within the organization is doing that? Every team might do it different, but the play calling coach is one that always sticks with me, that is there a gap in game management because they're focused on other things?
That's an interesting take. Like when I'm consulting companies, right? And it's the owner, and you have to have like a big 360 overview of how the business is operating. But then when that owner is like short-staffed and now he's on the line, you know, doing the day-to-day, all the like the remedial tasks, you really can't take a step back and look at everything. I feel like that's like very similar for football. So maybe some coaches do have the ability to do that because it does happen. You know, you do have like leaders in Fortune 500 companies that are able to do it, but not everyone. Most people cannot do that. And I do think it does take away. There's just too much going on, especially in the game of football, to compute everything.
Yeah,
I
it's always
think, go ahead, Jason.
no, it's always been a thing for me as I've looked at a lot of those coaches. I think some coaches can do it, but yeah, to your own, I think they really got to do that self-reflection inside and overall, like how are they managing the game so these things can move along. And there's a lot to play calling. Like play calling's not easy. We all sit at the sofa at home and talk about this. I'm gonna criticize every offensive coordinator under the sun, but you know, defenses are doing some, you know, exotic blitzes and different things, and you have this great play that looks great on on the dry erase board, but it doesn't come to fruition. Being able to have that, see those adjustments and move along, but also manage the bigger part of the game as the head coach, as the CEO on the field.
Difficult.
I think it's difficult.
That's
a good point. Yep.
That's valid. I think that's valid.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, but I think these coaches, I mean, you got to be looking ahead when you're calling plays. You know, if I can get in a certain situation, am I going to go for it? And you got those numbers, right? You got guys telling you, you know, we see it all the time. It's 3rd and 5, you know, hey, I'm going to run the ball, get 3 yards because I'm going to go for it on 4th and 2. You know, you got every team, every coach, every staff should have 6 to 8, 8 to 10, basically what we could call them 2-point conversion plays that are basically your short yardage, 4th and 1, 4th and 2. You know, we get inside the 45. You know, possessions are limited late in the game. So it could be like, hey, I'm going to punt it in the first half, but in the fourth quarter, I know I'm down 2 scores. Maybe I only got 3 possessions. I'm going to go for it on 4th and 3 or less inside the 45-yard line. So I think this stuff should be planned out by coaches, whether or not it is and how they manage it. Like Jason said, Andy Reid's probably one of the best at it. He sets up play calls just to get to Mahomes to certain situations where, hey, we're 4th and 3. Boom, we're going to hit Kelsey on a quick, you know, square out route or something like that. So it is a valid point, but coaches, you know, they need to be, if you cannot handle it and manage the game, you shouldn't be in that situation where you're calling the game.
I think it's also like a skill set thing, right? Andy Reid's a lot older than most of these coaches now. You know, that 10,000 hour rule. I strongly believe in that. He just has so much more experience. So he has been able to learn the ins and outs of play calling and still viewing the game from far away. He had, you know, lots of success and lots of failures in Philly. And now he's with KC. Like, he has a lot of experience to pull from, and that's what these other coaches don't have. So I think that's what kind of helps separate him from the rest of the pack.
Well, I think another thing is what happened the week before, right? Did you do something stupid and you lost, and now this week you're gun-shy because you don't want to criticize? Kind of like Brandon Staley with the Chargers. Remember year one, all he did was go for it, go for it, go for it. And then he cost his team the playoffs the last week of the year by basically calling a timeout when the Raiders were going to tie the game. And just let it go to overtime. They tie, they both get in the playoffs, and they don't, and the Steelers get in. Then year two, it's basically like, all right, well, I lost all these games last year doing this, even though the analytics say go for it, so I'm going to punt. So I think it kind of just varies week to week. Like, if you did it 1 week and it works, they call you like, oh, you know, he called the play, got it done, they got the win, you look great. If you do something stupid, then you basically, depending on what media market in, you look like a dummy. Andy Reid, like you said, he's got so much success and won so many games that, you know, he can get away with, you know, a bad call here. But, you know, his track record shows that, you know, he's going to be right more than he is wrong.
We don't have to touch on every game, but I did want to touch on the Bengals and Chiefs really quickly. In the AFC North, my Steelers are in first 2-0. And then you have teams that we talked about possibly making some noise in the playoffs with the Bengals and the Ravens. They're both 0-2. I'm not really panicked about either team. I really like the way the Bengals came out against the Chiefs. They looked really sharp. I don't know. I tried watching that replay again, that pass interference at the end of the game. They got the Chiefs in field goal position. I don't know if I would have called it myself, but
it was pretty blatant in PI. I mean, they had no choice but to call that.
Yeah, I know Twitter doesn't like it because it's generally a great meme or gif on Twitter as soon as this happens and favors the Chiefs, of like the Chiefs having the Chiefs jersey underneath, or the refs having the Chiefs jersey underneath, or something like that, where they're shaking Mahomes' hand and stuff. But it was a blatant PI. It's a tough call in that position because you give Mahomes and them the win for a very makeable field goal. But it comes down to these one or two plays here and there. And the Chiefs are not the team in their prime with Tyreek and explosions down the field. Like, these 2 Super Bowl year wins are very tight defensive games, you know, trying to protect the ball, you know, winning in the margins. And when it comes down to some of this stuff like that, where, you know, Mahomes can put the ball in the right spot for the receiver to get and put a defender in a position, you know, to make a blatant pass interference call, you know, these things are going to happen more than not.
Out of all the 2-0 teams, I think the Chiefs, they can easily be 0-2. I think they're the worst. Is that? I don't know if that's like the right thing to say, but they're my least favorite of the undefeated teams so far. Not a fan.
A lot of people said that last year. The Chiefs were done. I mean, That was what everyone was saying last year, and they had no chance when Tyreek left, and they lean way more on the defense than they did when they were putting a ton of points up, like I just said. So I think these games are going to be very close throughout the year. They're not going to blow anyone away, especially with Checo out. They're going to have to do something different on the run game. I think Kareem Hunt might be getting a look at the Chiefs, as if I saw some news breaking there too. So it's going to be different. So I know what you're saying, Rome, but I think when you're getting into like who you're betting against, very hard to bet against Patrick Mahomes and Andy Reid to really get it done and figure out a way to win these games.
Yeah, I mean, the Chiefs aren't the sexy 2-0 team right now. Like you said, Rome, they could easily be 0-2, you know, an inch here, you know, the defender, you know, split second comes in later. But, you know, like we said, Mahomes, Reid, those guys find ways to win games. And at the end of the day, it's about getting the W. And so for the Chiefs, you know, they're not going to be the explosive team like they were of Tyreek Hill. You know, I just saw that Hollywood Brown is out basically the whole season. He's not coming back till January.
Not coming back.
The rookie wide receiver was a no-show. Travis Kelce's looking old. The offensive line.
I feel like they're kind of shelving him a little bit. I really feel like they're managing his minutes now. Saving for the postseason.
I said that in our previous pods that I felt they would do that, because at the 17-game season right now, very hard. The health is going to matter really down the stretch. So, you know, what can they do differently to get other people involved to manage his minutes at this point, to make sure he's most effective down the stretch if he is a step or two slower than he used to be, but he's going to be the most effective team in the red zone. Aaron touched it earlier in the pod. That's what sets these championship teams apart from the teams that don't know what to do, is like how effective you are in the red zone. A lot of these younger teams, 20s to 20s, you know, they can go up and down the field and not get it done. Or you want Kelce and, you know, from Mahomes is going to be in that crunch time, in these moments, in the red zone, short field, making plays that basically are uncatchable balls to the defender.
Yeah, I mean, Mahomes and Kelce in the red zone, that's probably the number, you know, wide receiver, tight end / quarterback combination in the last 5 years. They finished drives. You know, they can run the ball. I mean, they had an offensive lineman come up and catch a touchdown in that game. Andy Reid knows how to design plays in the red zone. They convert more times in the red zone. Their defense is strong for them. They got a fumble for, you know, recovered scoop and score for a touchdown. That was a terrible turnover by Burrow. Cincinnati outplayed them. Cincinnati should have won that game. They didn't. Me and Rome, we talked about this. You know, say what you want. Kansas City doesn't want to see the Cincinnati Bengals in the playoffs. It is their kryptonite. Cincinnati's outplayed them every time Burrow's been on the field healthy. He's outplayed Mahomes every time. Mahomes, I think, threw for his lowest total ever for a game he completed of 151 yards, couple interceptions. Cincinnati just knows how to play against big teams and big games. They're not afraid of the moment. They might lay an egg against New England, and we might just write them off as like one of the worst teams in the league, and then they come back and play the Chiefs, and you're like, okay, this is who I expect the Bengals to be. I'm not panicked on the Bengals at 0-2, but I am on the Ravens at 0-2. I'm really concerned about Baltimore.
I really liked how Gesicki got involved in this game and Burrow got him passed. I think that gives an element that you didn't see when you had, you know, Higgins and Jamar, and they had Tyler Boyd in years past.
Had 100 yards, right?
Yeah, I mean, he was like, I think 7 catches for 91 yards, Gesicki was. And he was super effective in Miami pre, you know.
Why did Miami let him go? Because now they don't really have a tight end.
McDaniel didn't use him, and that was the big thing year one of McDaniel, was Gesicki was getting no love because they did that. And so, remember last year,
Gesicki was with the Patriots last year, wasn't he?
He was, and didn't get the love last year where he was at.
Nobody got any love with the Patriots.
Yeah.
I'm like, how come I don't remember on the Patriots, but that offense was terrible last year.
It was terrible. But, I mean, when you think Gesicki pre-McDaniel in Miami, like, he was the guy on offense that they were getting that ball to there into the Brian Flores era. So, tight end for the Bengals hasn't been a really bright spot, but I think that gives them a different element as, you know, Higgins is out of the lineup, you know, and having something opposite Jamar for Burrow to work the middle of the field. And if they can get the right pass protection around Burrow to keep him upright this year. I agree with Aaron, not to worry. I'm not worried about the Ravens either. I know Aaron talked about it, but the Ravens, the Steelers, I mean, these are the teams that grind it out and figure out a way to get into the playoffs at a certain point. So, but very, very interesting. Both are 0-2 though, because I think these are teams that 1-2 in division, potentially everyone's seeing, and Rome Steelers are now sitting on top of the division scoring like 12 points a game or something like that.
I will say this before we close out. I was worried about the Bengals, but the way they showed up, beating up on the Chiefs, Burrow looked good. I like them moving forward. They're the best looking 0-2 team for sure. Let's come back and do some college football. Cool, we're back to briefly cover college football. It's a late night already. Couple things. Just want to give props to like Michigan and Notre Dame recovering from their losses. We'll go over Michigan a little bit more next time, but Davis Warren, 2 touchdowns, 6 interceptions so far this season. Not looking good. Aaron, that anemic offense, you called it. They lost everybody in the draft. We'll talk more about that, but let's go to Georgia, barely escaping Kentucky. 13-12. I did not see that coming. And I think Georgia has like one of these games every single year where they almost get their ass kicked and it just wakes them up and then they just go on this fucking run. So is this kind of like the same thing or?
Feels like the same thing. I think they got Alabama coming up here pretty soon. So maybe they were looking ahead. You know, they got a lot of trouble in the offseason with those speeding tickets and obviously drinking the Kentucky bourbon before this game started. But hey, college football, it's about escaping with wins. And they did that. We were talking before we went on, you know, big segment. We've been talking about clock management, managing games. Mark Stoops with the dummy of the weekend, 4th and 8 at midfield with 3.5 minutes to go, 1 timeout. I know with college football now has that 2-minute timeout. We can't call it the 2-minute warning because the NFL has that name patented, but the 2-minute timeout, punts the ball away, never gets it back again. That, you know, was a dumb move by Kentucky. Mark Stoops, you're in a game. You shouldn't be in the game. You're 3-touchdown underdog. You got to go for it there, Jason. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I got to agree with that. I feel like we talked about time management this and you know, half of this podcast right now, but you got this opportunity to beat Georgia. You don't want to give them the ball where they're just going to just bleed the clock when you're in this kind of slugfest. Just it's a field goal game. And you kind of just let it kind of pass for you. But I agree with Rome at the top. Georgia has these games, but still, I don't think they've lost a regular season game. And is it 3.5 years at this point, the last time they lost in the regular season from
I think
a Georgia
50-0 in non-conference and SEC games outside of playing Alabama.
Yeah.
Outside of playing Alabama. Everybody but Alabama.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this could have been the shot they were at. Didn't see a ton from back at quarterback throughout the game. Only threw for like 160 yards. Just kind of that SEC slugfest. A little bit, Aaron, like you said, them looking ahead to Alabama, I think is in 2 weeks. Georgia's got the bye. Then it's, you know, 2 top 5 programs going at it with Georgia and Alabama. You know, at a point there in the SEC, you're going to have like 3 of the top 5 teams, all SEC schools. So actually, they might have 4 of the top 5. I forgot about Ole Miss hanging out there too. So, Just a lot of huge games coming up. And if you're overlooking or saving anything and being super conservative from a Georgia perspective, knowing that you should roll Kentucky. It was really the only entertaining game of the weekend. I don't know how entertaining a 13-12 game is, but I mean, as a Bears fan, 13-12 is really every game. But every game across this college football slate this weekend for ranked teams was all blowouts that were like 30-40 point blowouts and teams getting set. So, overall, I think it was kind of just a Passover week in the college football, on the college football side. The only other ranked game that was out there was Missouri and Boston College. That was like a 27-21, pretty tight game, and Missouri, another SEC school hanging out there. So I think people were throwing a lot of shade for some SEC schools earlier in the year, but you look at Missouri, Ole Miss, Alabama, Texas, Georgia, all 3-0 here in their early slates, like
Tennessee,
forgot about that. It's going to be, it's going to be just a gauntlet going through the SEC.
The SEC is already asking for 14 team playoff because basically half the conference would be in it.
Yeah. You know, Bama, Oklahoma, You know, I think they're ranked, you know, 15th or 3-0 too. So just a lot. LSU losing that game early in the season, you know, is kind of the team kind of sitting on the outs there. But
that was a good game, LSU and South Carolina.
Yeah.
Yeah. South Carolina got their quarterback hurt, early second quarter. That really turned that flow of that game. LSU can't stop anybody. They've got your Bruins coming up this weekend, Rome.
You're right. Yeah. LSU got so lucky coming out of there. That was like a really close game. I didn't catch too much of the Boston College one. I did pick them as like an upset over Missouri, but Missouri really came through. I think we're talking about whether they were like legitimately a really good team or not. We mentioned some other. It was a lot of blowouts. Oregon manhandled Oregon State. Texas beat their opponent up. UTSA. Quinn Ewers went out with an abdominal strain, and Arch Manning like came out on fire. Four touchdowns, another one rushing. He's quick. I didn't know Manning could.
Arch Manning running for 50 plus yard TD run. That was probably the surprise of the weekend. I had to pause the television, rewind, and make sure that said Manning on the back of that jersey.
Yeah, Manning, and he was white. I had to do a double take. I was like, wow,
he's got
this
great hair. And he's got great hair. Unlike the other Mannings.
Well, I mean, this was the Manning prodigy that everyone was kind of waiting for, but he was behind Ewers the whole time. It was he didn't get his shot. Comes in his game, four touchdowns overall, dynamic playmaker. I saw a lot of the Carolina Panther accounts about tanking for Arch. Not that they actually need to tank because they're that bad, but that'll be an interesting thing, I think, foreshadowed when Arch Manning's in the draft, because this is the family that held out going to the San Diego Chargers. Yeah, so I mean that's Mrs. Toler's favorite team out there. You know, I'm not going to that. So Arch Manning ain't going to the Carolina Panthers. I can tell you they're gonna be holding him out for a primo situation when that's coming out. If this is what you're gonna expect to see,
I wouldn't let my team play for the Panthers. No fucking chance.
But I mean, it's a great first impression. You know, curious how much more he's going to get, you know, between Euros, how much time does he have left? I can't even remember where he's at right now. Is he only a junior? No,
no, Manning's a sophomore.
No, Manning's a sophomore, but when's Manning?
I think he's a senior.
Okay.
Yeah, Euros a senior. This is it.
Okay. Redshirt senior, I believe.
Yeah, he could have went into the draft. He stayed for another year to potentially come, you know, try to win a championship.
Pick, yeah.
Yeah, and I think they look like Michigan from last year, so they're still my favorites to be there at the end.
But they got, you know, they got, at least got a succession plan with Manning going on here, as opposed to, you know, the covered bear with Michigan. So, I think a lot of people excited to watch Manning play, and you know, what's he going to be able to do in Saturdays as a starter this next couple of years, and then eventually in the pro career. But a good at least first impression from what people saw this weekend.
Yeah, another big blowout. You're Notre Dame beating up on Purdue 66-7, taking all that aggression out from the previous week's loss. I'm pretty sure you're happy about it.
Absolutely happy. I said at the beginning of the year, I mean, this is a team that potentially can go undefeated if they got past Texas A&M. Had the slip up at home to Northern Illinois, but I think Northern Illinois is going to surprise some people. I think we talked about it last week. Northern Illinois in the MAC, you know, they're going to have some good matching games. They got a pretty senior-laden team. They got ranked after that defeat of Notre Dame. You know, they could be a team that is, you know, rivaling with Boise State and Memphis as one of these non-conference invitees into the college football playoff. So I'm hoping Northern Illinois, you know, has a good year. It'll make the Notre Dame loss look a little bit better for Notre Dame to get that invite that I think they still, you know, have the opportunity to get, because, you know, they're going to play a bad Florida State team, and then if USC is kind of still hanging in there, it would be a depressive loss or even over USC. So there's going to be there's not a lot of things for Notre Dame to slip up on going forward if they continue to have performances. Getting the ball to Jeremiah Love, I think, is the key. He only had 10 carries in the game because it was over pretty quick. But when they got going against Texas A&M, when they came kind of back versus Northern Illinois, it was getting him the ball and, you know, making some dynamic plays in the running game. So I think that'll be key as we go down the stretch here.
Let's just talk about Aaron Seminoles really quick. Man, I just want to see that frown on his face. 0-3. Florida's losing as well. I can't remember who mentioned it though, but it's very rare for like a top 10 team to be 0-3, just out of the rankings like this quick.
I think it's only happened one other time in the AP poll history, I believe, what I read.
Yeah, it was crazy. Aaron, man, how you feeling? Like, tell what's going on.
It's been rough, but you know, for my Memphis pick being a group of five non-power four conference teams, that's looking pretty sweet. I thought this would be a tough game going into the season before Florida State even started 0-2 beforehand. Seminoles, you know, it's kind of hard to say. You know, they had the bye week after the lost Labor Day against Boston College and then actually came out and looked worse, which I didn't expect that to happen. I thought they would beat Memphis. They didn't. 0-3, I think, for the first time since the Bobby Bowden era, when his first season as coach.
No, this is the second time.
Second time with Mike Norvell there, yeah. So Norvell did start 0-4 in the 2020 season, I believe.
Yeah, second time in 3 years, 4 years,
something like that.
So are they getting off? Are they gonna get the win this year, this week? I'm sorry, versus Cal, or you know, when are they gonna get back on here?
That's a great question. I mean, you would have asked me a month, California. If you would have asked me a month ago or 6 months ago when the schedule came out, I thought Cal was a walkthrough win. Cal's 3-0 and actually playing better than I thought. They have a win at Auburn, so they're not bad. I wouldn't be surprised if California beats Florida State. I think Florida State needs to make a change at quarterback. I think that's the number one thing. DJU just looks lost. He looks like Bryce Young, deer in the headlights, just confused, doesn't have anything going for him. I would go to Brock Lynn, get him in there, get the spark going, see if he can light this team a fire under their ass and see if they can get a win at home.
We didn't talk about this, did we?
No, let's not talk about them.
All right, sounds good.
So, look. Florida State schedule, I mean, I want to say it's not an overly hard schedule, but if they don't get past Cal, they play SMU.
They need to beat Cal. SMU's probably going to beat them.
Yeah.
Then they get Clemson. They're going to get beat by Clemson. They got Duke and North Carolina winnable games.
But then they have Miami.
They got Notre Dame, Miami losses. North Alabama should be a win. And then if they beat Cal, they can maybe get to 6 wins. If they don't, they're looking at maybe 4-5. And that's nice.
What point is Norvell gone in this season?
That's what I was thinking too.
Norvell, I think, is safe. I mean, it's a $65 million buyout. People are kind of getting hot on Norvell. I really don't get it. I mean, we talk about Florida State. They came in with high expectations, I think a little bit higher. But I think everybody's kind of underestimating their opponents. Georgia Tech's better than what we thought. Boston College is better than we thought. We all agree Memphis is one of the top five, not group of five non-power four teams. So their schedule has been, I mean, they shouldn't be 0-3, don't get me wrong, but their opponents have been playing better than people expected. The ACC as a whole has not been great, but I think their opponents that they started with have been good. And then Cal, I mean, Cal's 3-0. They beat Auburn. There was a 2-touchdown underdog at Auburn. Auburn obviously is 2-1 in the SEC, so they're not bad. Whenever you coach in the state of Florida, whether it's Miami, Florida State, or Florida, any of the big three schools down there, you're always on the hot seat, man. Like the humidity, dude. The hot seat's always warm down there. I think as long as Norvell, the team doesn't quit on him, he'll be back. Like we were talked about, I mean, he started first year there, this program went 3-5. The next year they started 0-4. He got him to 5-7. Then they've had, I mean, this is a team we're talking about that won 19 straight games before basically losing to Georgia and starting 0-3 this year. So you're talking about a stretch. Yeah, so it doesn't look good, but from all the talk is, the players talked about accountability stepping up. They haven't quit on Norvell. I think major changes are coming to the program, whether or not Norvell saves his job or not, is who becomes available. You know, Lane Kiffin has been interested maybe in going to Florida with the Gators. If that opens up, does Florida State say, hey, we jump in early and try to get him? What other major coaches are going to be out there? There's some good coaches. I like the Missouri coach in the SEC. If he becomes available, if Florida State wants to go and get him. And then the elephant in the room is Ryan Day at Ohio State. Everybody talks about firing him if he can't beat Michigan and win a national championship. If Ohio State was stupid enough to move off him and Florida State wanted to make a move, they could go there. But Mike Norvell, let's not forget, he was the number two coach behind Kellen DeBoer to get hired at Alabama. And that's why Florida State jumped up and gave him the $10 million raise and $85 million contract. So this isn't a guy that just overnight got stupid. The program has been recruiting good to average. Mike Norvell's kind of his cliche has been the king of the transfer portal. I mean, if you look it up, Mike Norvell is the king of the transfer portal. They wanted Cam Ward. They didn't pony up the money. He went to Miami, and that's going to come back to haunt him because we've seen what Cam Ward's doing at Miami. If Cam Ward was at Florida State, they would be 3-0. That really is kind of the difference right now.
They definitely got the wrong guy. I did want to touch on, was it like that last Friday, Kansas State taking care of Arizona?
Kansas State, man. I got them winning the Big 12.
That was a nice game. Weren't you up on Arizona for them to do well this year?
Well, that was their first loss. I mean, I thought Arizona would play a lot better than they did. But, you know, you got Pac-12 teams joining new conferences. It gets a little rough. It's tough to win on Manhattan, Kansas. Give Kansas State a lot of credit.
Arizona was one of the teams, I think, that were picked by several people as far as, you know, an up-and-coming could surprise you. Not, you know, the traditional football powerhouse. Not going to win the Big 12. Aaron said Kansas State. Utah, for me, was my pick. I still think that's an impressive team coming over from the Pac-12 that really can air it out. I mean, they had the in-state rivalry game with Utah State. Were able to, you know, do it, take care of business there. But going to be
With a backup quarterback, too.
Yep. So, but it would be interesting. The Big 12, as you lose your two pillars of the conference in Texas and Oklahoma, but have some really good backfills into that conference with Arizona, Utah, and still have competitive teams with Oklahoma State and Kansas State. Interesting conference this year. I know a lot of people were thinking Kansas was going to be a shocker, but they have laid the dud so far this year. But Big 12 could be an interesting thing, conference coming down the stretch, and which team for them potentially is in that first round bye from a top four conference perspective.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, Jason, Kansas is a team that people had high hopes on. Team we're not talking about is a group of five, nine power four conference at UNLV. UNLV is a really good football team. They've got some impressive wins against Kansas and Houston in the Big 12 conference. And Utah, they got a big game, Oklahoma State this week. And we know Oklahoma State, Mike Gundy, always finds a way to win 8 to 10 games every year. That should be a good game on Saturday.
Yeah, curious as we look kind of a long-term view of college football right now. There was a lot of consolidation with really the disillusion of the Pac-12 and a lot of the, those teams going around. But the amount of non-Power 5 teams we've kind of talked about that are really good, giving me a lot of these Power 5 or Power 4 at this point. But, the big conference is getting scared by some of these. Hey, we're thinking UNLV. We talk a lot about Boise State, Aaron's, Memphis Tigers. There's a lot of teams here where I'm curious as the transfer portal and some of the NIL stuff, some of these guys that are three-star recruits or maybe four-star recruits in the transfer portal going to these other universities. And you see some of these, non-traditional, non-Power 5, conference, teams start to rise up. Rome, I think you sent me something about the reformation of the Pac-12 with some bunch of Mountain West schools and stuff. So, there could be, a real, resurgence potentially for, some different stuff from the conference. I think the playoff, for all maybe naysayers, I don't think there's many, but I think really gives a spotlight to a bunch of these schools. If they go in and beat a couple big teams and make runs, those are teams that potentially are on schedules that people don't want to see, don't want to play against.
Yeah, I don't think we're done with all that restructuring. I think it's going to look different again in 5 years. And if there's ever a major new network deal that comes out that's worth billions of dollars that could kind of restructure the way college football is, because it's basically now, how are they having in Europe? Soccer.
Man. It's money and contracts.
It's a pro league. It's a pro league.
Oh, it's the second biggest sport in the U.S. is college football, NFL and college football, and nothing really comes after that. I'd say the only difference of the reverse is what they do in Europe, which I'm a fan of, but will never happen in the U.S., is them doing actually like relegation stuff.
I love it.
Because if we were doing Europe stuff, Florida State be relegated out of the ACC this year. And would have
hey,
to,
they
would
won
have,
out of the ACC,
yeah.
man.
Yeah, but they
won
they,
out.
They wouldn't be able to go to the SEC, though. They'd have to go to like the MAC or something like that.
I've got a wild idea. It will never happen.
Let's
I don't
it.
Know if I touch base with Rome on it, but with the Pac-12 now Pac-6, if you look at some of these teams that want out of their conference and that are free agents, it won't happen. But I would love to see Notre Dame shock the world and go and join the Pac-12. I would love to see Florida State get out of the ACC with Clemson and join the Pac-12. And kind of some weird schools like that just get out and form their own thing where basically we got a coast-to-coast conference and it's a power conference. It will never probably happen. I think conferences are just going to get passed over here anyways, and we're going to go to more like an NFL kind of scheduling format. But I want to touch on something Jason said too. Of NIL, all these group of five, non-power four, I think the days of dynasty blue blood programs dominating is going to go by the wayside. It's going to basically become billionaire booster people coming in. And if you want to make a program profitable and spend money on NIL, you can become good for 1 or 2 years and to have a shot at winning a national championship.
And the key in the transfer portal, Nick Saban went viral a couple of weeks ago on ESPN talking through like all this, you know, you're going to buy a $50 million roster or something, but for him, and I think the point that was obvious, but everybody thought funny, is like you could still be shit and be a $50 million, you know, and do a $50 million investment in some of this NIL stuff. You got to spend the money right.
Well, just look at Florida State, bro.
Look at Florida State. And then on the flip side, you look at Miami, where you mentioned Cam Ward. He goes there. What did Miami not have last year? They didn't get out of Van Dyke of elevating that team with all the skill players around that. You go in the portal, you get Cam Ward. Now you have that. So what's junior or senior quarterbacks that we've seen kind of go into the portal where you're kind of, hey, you're buying a guy that maybe had some playing time at a lower level program and then is going to go somewhere else. I think it's the Arizona quarterback. People were talking about like, oh, that guy's in Bama in 2 years, something like that. Like when he's doing
his graduate
degree.
Well, you're seeing
that
a lot with kickers now, right? I think Bama or somebody just, you know, here's the thing about the transfer portal. You can put your name in and then everybody just starts calling you up. You don't need a transfer. You just have to put your name in this portal. And then all of a sudden people are just saying, you know, hey, Jason, we want you for, you know, Rome said, you know, Colorado State had two players turn down $600,000 to return to Colorado State. I guarantee you that quarterback, he hasn't looked good, but if that offer is on the table right now, he would take it. So you just put your name out there and then you go to your coach or you go to the university and go like, hey, here's my text messages. Here's my emails. I got $1.5 million to go kick at Alabama. Are you going to match it? And the Kent State's not going to match it. They're going to be like, dude, like we're getting $1.5 million to go get our butts kicked by Notre Dame on a Saturday. Like, we don't care if you kick a field goal or not. We'll go find some, you know, walk-on in the classroom to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. But Rome's right. This isn't the end of, I think, the reshaping. How does college football, you know, potentially break away from the NCAA as a whole as you have these kind of teams and create their own like individual monopoly? Like, you know, the Big Ten probably wants Notre Dame. They've heard they want Miami. You know, they get to 18, 20 schools. You know, if Florida State gets out of the ACC and they're going to go like to the SEC, you know, do you have just three conferences that both have 20 teams and you got this 60 team power league with three, you know, different conferences? Like, there's a lot
there'll
of
be all the good conferences. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The problem with the ACC is they have the, you know, the right grant of rights till 2036 of all the teams. Like, yeah, Florida State wants out, but the buyout is, I've heard, anywhere from 300 to 500 million, and nobody's going to pay that.
I'm sure they're idiots, and everyone knows that they're idiots.
Yeah. But yeah. The deal was structured in 2016.
It was a
20 year deal in 2016.
It was one of the great deals from ESPN and former, you know, president John Skipper, because, you know, I think his visionary mind for ESPN at that right was like, I'm investing in something that's going to be worth a lot. College football's, you know, worth a lot. And, you know, it's not great for the schools, because when you look what the Big Ten got from Fox, what the SEC got from ESPN, what the Big 12 got from a couple different avenues too. So yeah, these teams aren't getting the money to compete, and that's why they want to get out. So yeah, from the schools isn't there, but that's where you know, that's where we see maybe the shakeup at some point. But yeah, when that deal expires half a decade from now, it'll be some valuable rights depending on how that, you know, how that shakes out for those teams.
Before we wrap things up, I just want to give some love to Nebraska for being 3-0 right now. They won 34-3 against Northern Iowa. Riola, 2 touchdowns. I'm rocking an old Nebraska sweater. I'm drinking
That thing looks like it hasn't been washed in a few years. Where'd you just pull that out of the freaking...
I just washed it.
Yeah. It hasn't been washed since Tom Osborne was head coach. That was the last time it was washed.
Since Scott Frost ran in one of those touchdowns.
Eric Crouch was still being talked about for Heisman consideration.
I got my...
drafted by the Rams in the 7th round or 6th round.
Never forgot you, Nebraska. Been a loyal fan. Maybe I've been quiet for a few years. I'm back.
I'm glad to see Nebraska back, man.
Me too. Cool. Anything else?
I'm guessing we're not talking about Formula One this week.
We can talk about it.
No, we're kidding.
Oh, before we go, real quick, I did catch the boxing matches. Canelo, I was watching with a friend who's allegedly a big boxing guy. Wouldn't shut the fuck up about Canelo, but Canelo did manhandled the, I can't remember his name, but it was really fun. Got knocked down a few times, but I just feel like boxing is so rigged. Canelo dominated the fight, but just doesn't get any knockouts. I just feel like they kind of drag that on along so much. And then we caught some of the USC fights. That girl is really hot. Can't remember if I was texting you guys or not.
Alex Grosso?
Yeah, she's really pretty.
Well, Canelo versus, I can't remember what his name was, is every Canelo fight for me, I think, twice a year. So that, I think that sums up the state of boxing. You're not going to get a lot of boxing takes from me on this pod. All I can say about Canelo is that in the streets, when I have my red beard grown out, I will get, you know, mistaken for Canelo. And he's going to box, you know, 2 times a year versus a tomato can that, you know, very few people are going to know, and a fight that no one will probably remember.
Yeah, dude, you kind of look like Canelo. You guys are both white with red hair. Just need like a little Mexican accent. You're good to go.
Don't have that.
We'll send him some 10-ounce, 12-ounce gloves, and he can wear those next time on the pod. Yeah. You know, put a little boxing punch bag back there, and you're good to go.
Jason, do you do any accents? Could you give us like a little...
I do no accents. So no, I can't. I can't give you that. No, can't give you any accents on that.
Aaron, do you like the crew?
Yeah, I mean UFC 306 was overall, I thought, a pretty good event. We saw two new champions crowned in the women's division. Valentina won that fight, and then you know Shauna O'Reilly. Yeah, she dominated. Just took her to the ground, grappled her, wrestled her, ground and pound, controlled that fight. Right. She had about 8 takedowns, and then Sean O'Malley getting beat in the main event on that card by Marab. So overall, the 306 was good. The first two fights, a lot of action. I mean, that first fight, the dude got hit with a 1-2. I thought he was going to get choked out. Came back, won that fight. The second fight, dude in the last round, like got hit, was just get like a punching bag, like Canelo was fighting the dude and just hitting him for like a minute. Referee looked like half a dozen times he's going to stop the fight. He's yelling, fight back. The dude's just swinging at air. I mean, he was just swinging at air, but, you know. I think the surprising thing is every fight on the main card all went to decision. That's very rare. They all went to the scorecards. But overall, that was a really good night. Yeah, for the Spear, man. That was a pretty interesting event, man. For the Spear,
great.
It was, yeah, that was pretty awesome.
Yeah,
yeah, it's an interesting venue. I will say for me, I've only seen a wrestling event on TV for that. NXT had a little pay-per-view on there a while back, but it'll be interesting what they put inside the Sphere. More events like this, you know, if they do any boxing stuff.
It's a lot of money, though. I think the UFC had to spend $20 million just on production alone.
Why so much?
Just because of how it's everything set up in there. I haven't been in there, but just how it's all set up, all the digital features and all that. Yeah, the UFC said it was going to be a one-off, but the reviews and everybody loved it so much, it might be something we see more of. But yeah, production cost is really, really high.
Cool, man. I think that does it then. We'll come back on Thursday, go over NFL lines, some college football games to watch.
Sounds good.
Like a plan.
When are we going to fit in some baseball?
When postseason starts, I guess.
We're into a great stretch where the Angels are flirting with potentially their worst season in history. And my Chicago White Sox are chasing history to be the absolute worst team of all time. So some exciting baseball here in the next week and a half if you're looking to all-time terrible baseball being played right now.
We should do like a segment on that. That'd be great.
I have plenty in the can for the White Sox, Jerry Reinsdorf, Chris Getz, and all of the White Sox leadership.
Let's make it a special, man. It'll be Jason is on a rant, going crazy.
Yeah, and then he can talk Formula One, too.
Man, that'd be a big episode for me, all right? The Azerbaijan Grand Prix last week. Great, great race. Great win by Oscar Piastri.
I wish I knew more about F1. I do have some complaints about it, though, so yeah. Awesome. Two cents about it.
All right. Well, you just let me know. We'll put that on the pod.
I know. I'm going to try to get Alex on here.
We'll have a special guest for that, too. We'll have a special guest for Formula One. Yeah.
I'll try to get Alex on here. Spicy Italian. He looks the part, dude. It's going to be great. It'll be fun. Cool. Take it easy, guys. We'll be back on Thursday.
Thanks, guys.